Good evening. One last class on Shobogenzo. What's that?
The survivors.
The survivors, yes. This is a hard one this evening, finishing off this this fascicle. Dogen's really doing his Dogen thing. And just to remind us that there's this topic of the relationship of dharmas, phenomena, dharmas as phenomena, and dharmata, or the nature of phenomena. And this can also be called the two truths. The conventional truth of phenomenal appearances that arise due to conditions and cease due to conditions moment by moment, the so-called world, and the dharmata is the nature of these phenomenal appearances, that there's nothing actually behind them, there's no essence, there's no substance to them. They're empty and ungraspable, though they vividly appear as our lives. And I came across this teaching, some old note I found about these two truths, which is the unity of the two truths is also, we call the middle way. So that's why a lot of these topics for this year, I'm studying the middle way, are about this relationship of these two truths, which is to me an amazing topic. It's not at all simple and straightforward, and there's ongoing debates within Dharma circles for ever since the time of Buddha of what exactly is the relationship between the conventional and the ultimate. It's not like there's a definitive statement about that relationship. But anyway, one of these teachers, some teacher in the ancient Tibetan tradition, talked about the practice of what's the practice with the conventional truth, what's the practice with dharmas, what's the practice with appearances of the world, and you could say the practice is just being with them, just something like just being with what's right in front of us without manipulating it or messing with it is how you practice with the conventional truth. It's not exactly that it's ultimately real. It's like an appearance, a dependently arisen appearance of me and you and Zendo and so on. And like a dream, it's often said. But what's the practice with that? To just be vividly and clearly with what's happening without manipulating it. And you could say, the ultimate truth actually can't be manipulated. There's nothing there to manipulate. But in the conventional world, it seems as if we can mess with the world and manipulate it. And so to not do that, but not to avoid it either, or try to get around the conventional truth and into some, you know, non-doing ultimate is impossible. So to be with things without manipulating them is like the practice with dharmas. And then when we're that way with dharmas, dharmata is realized right there. It's like right there as the nature of phenomena. But if we're manipulating and meddling with phenomena at that time, it's like, I think, impossible to see the dharmata, right? Because we're taking them too seriously. Right? We're getting caught up in things, and now they're not just dependently arisen appearances. they seem to us as if they're really substantially real, and now we're like trying to, you know, put ourselves in there and make them be the way we want them to be, something like that. And therefore we can't see the Dharmata. So I thought that was a really neat instruction, that the by simply being with things the way they appear, which is the conventional truth, the way that they actually are is revealed. By simply being with dharmas, the dharmata is revealed. And therefore, this relationship is that they're not really separate, the phenomena and their true nature. But yet we talk about, I think it's good to talk about these two different aspects of conventional and ultimate. Yes.
Is not messing with the dharmas, is that the same as ending delusion? Dharma gates or... No, I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. Is there any connection? Do you think?
Yeah. I think that we might say ending delusion is realizing dharmata. That might be one way to say it. Ending delusion, that things substantially exist, is realizing the true nature of things. And by not manipulating things, right at the moment of non-manipulation, delusion can be ended. I don't know if I would equate them. It's more like, I would say almost like that's the practice to end delusion.
Not
I would say,
manipulating.
Yeah, not manipulating. Because I think we could be like simply not manipulating things, but still not quite, not be looking deeply at the same time to see that their true nature is non-abiding suchness.
So maybe it's kind of an entry
point. Yeah, it's an entry point. That's how I would say it, yeah.
Practical.
Yeah, practical. Entry point. Practical entry point. Yeah.
So this instruction, do you think if one has never had the experience, I guess because, you know, when you say this, I know what you're talking about. I feel like I've had the experience. If I hadn't had the experience, I don't know if this would help.
The experience of what?
Of not manipulating and being present with what is and feeling different than usual.
Yeah, and how that is. Because I think we could say there's two experiences in a way, what we're talking about, what Kathy's bringing up. But we could say there's the experience of just simply being with things and not manipulating them, which is a nice way to be with things, is peaceful. Mm-hmm. And then we could say there's the experience of dharmata, which might be like something deeper. I mean, we have to be careful here because we don't want to separate these things either. Mm-hmm. It's the tricky part. But I think we can, you know, we can tell people, we can hear the Zen instructions like, just relax with things as they are, and we can do that practice, and it cools us down. But it's not necessarily realizing the true nature of things. So I think, in a way, you could say there's two slightly different experiences. And one question we could ask is, I thought maybe you were asking, like, if we haven't had the experience of the true nature of things, then to just say, just be with things as they are without manipulating, will you necessarily realize that if you haven't heard about it? I think that's an interesting question. And I would say, actually, no. I think usually maybe we wouldn't realize the nature of things. Because you can tell, I mean, this would be like one story about this would be like there's all these different traditions of meditative calm abiding where you just get really cool with things and you're not manipulating the world. You're relaxed and settled, but we wouldn't call that enlightenment, right? So, and like in the Buddha's time, there were people doing like amazing yogic piecing out and blissing out, but it wasn't like Buddha Dharma yet. So I think that's always an interesting topic because we say, well, isn't it really the same? They say, well, if it was, then what's the big deal about Buddha? There were all these other yogis, like, long before him. So it seemed like he realized Dharmata, maybe for the first time in this world system. I mean, according to the story of Buddha. What was different there? There were people already, like, totally peaceful. So I think it's a kind of an insight into the nature of things that we hear through the Buddha's particular teachings and lineage of teachings through the Zen ancestors. It's a particular description of reality, like that things are empty. I mean, this teaching wasn't around, this emptiness teaching, before the Buddha. And so people might realize that if they get really, really non-manipulative, like really, really just totally being present without grasping or aversion. They might realize that, like the Buddha actually did realize it without having heard it before. We say he was the one in our current world system. But after him, everybody heard it. I mean, that's how these stories usually go. They didn't necessarily hear the Buddha's sutras, but they heard these strange talks of the Zen ancestors that were pointing to the same thing in a new way. So, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thinking about the word manipulate and what word might we use instead for the bodhisattva vow, where we're engaging with the dharmas.
Mm.
Manipulating feels too like too strong of a word, as if there are things to actually.
Yeah.
But I wonder what word you would use for the way in which we actually do engage with some motivation to reduce suffering. So we are engaging in.
Yeah.
And,
or how about harmonizing with dharmas? Right.
Knowing that they are empty. So dharma and at the same time, knowing that they are empty and discrete individual self.
And we might come to be able to see that emptiness or dharmata by harmonizing with. And these are like non-manipulation and harmonizing with there's no fixed thing, you know, description of what that is in any particular situation, right? That's the tricky part is, well, like, if we're having, you know, an argument with someone, we might think non-manipulation would be like immediately stop the argument or just agree with what they say would be to harmonize. But I don't think that's quite it. So it's quite subtle. But it's also not like, I don't even care what you say because I'm right. And I'm going to try to convince you because you're wrong and I'm right. And that's the way it is. Don't try to convince me otherwise. That would be like a little more like manipulation, usually, I think. And not harmonizing. But it's, you know, as we know, this is nothing new for us, right? But it's how do we know when we're not manipulating, or how do we know when we're harmonizing? Maybe, well, we don't really know.
Forgetting the self?
Yeah, or maybe there's a kind of a peacefulness. It's a kind of, it might be a very energetic, dynamic situation, but there's an underlying okayness. Whereas I think if we're manipulating, there's a strong sense of self and other separation, and that's unsettling and feels like icky. Yeah.
Well, I think when we're harmonizing, we're working with the other rather than trying to push ourselves on them. We're actually listening and asking and changing our view depending on what we hear.
Yeah. There's a kind of openness.
Yeah, there's an interrelational
quality,
which is different. It's engagement.
Yeah.
It could even be trying to be persuasive, but it's not pushing. And, you know, I mean, it takes into account what's coming from here.
And knowing that we're not in control.
Yeah, and that ultimately it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, yes. Yep, that would be part of the bigger view.
You're wrong. What do you do?
It's hard to do sometimes, right? But it's often a fine line, I think, as we know. It's a fine line, yeah.
I can easily realize when I'm sitting that whatever this is, the dharma going through my mind is insubstantial and doesn't remain, obviously. And so what use would it be to try to manipulate something that is just changing? It doesn't really have a permanent existence. So how would I get a handle on it?
Yeah.
And to me, that recognizing that it's just changing all the time. The thoughts in my head are always changing. And my heart is always beating, and I'm not the same person that I was at the last heartbeat.
Yeah.
There's nothing to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no point in trying to manipulate it.
Mm-hmm. But we forget that constantly.
So that part of maybe samadhi I can get to when I realize that this is just insubstantial. There's no layer to manipulate.
So you could say that knowing that truth, that's Buddha's teaching,
so
helps us to do that.
I'm not sure. I guess, I suppose, because of the myriad things, it couldn't be the myriad things unless there was the Dharmaka.
And it couldn't be the Dharmata unless there's the
myriad things. But it's obvious that there are the myriad things, of which I am one at any moment.
Yeah. Yeah, they can't be
and
separate.
That's about as far as I've gotten. that's
pretty far.
Well, anyway, Dharma gates is. Can I ask what those are at this point, or is that out of the scope of this?
And that in Dharma, in that case, I think usually refers to like the like Dharma as like teachings of truth.
Mm-hmm.
So the gateways to like Buddha's
mm-hmm.
truth are numberless.
Okay. Sometimes I have been thinking of it as a particular little dharma presents itself.
Mm-hmm. You could hear it that way too. Mm-hmm.
Awakens me somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you
Maybe
could say that.
I realize this is the way it is and I can't change it.
In that way, I think it's true. Yeah, every phenomena is a gateway to truth, right? And I vow to enter them. I mean, again, in the Chinese, it literally says, I vow to study or learn them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just our English translation says enter. So by our English translation, it's maybe more, this makes it more universal. Mm-hmm. Everything is a gateway to enter. But I think the original meaning was maybe more like, there's all these many teachings. I've had to learn all the Buddha's teachings.
Mm-hmm.
I think was more the flavor of the original.
Okay.
But both are nice.
I wouldn't recognize the little dharma as a gateway to awakening unless I had heard the teachings.
Exactly. This teaching is kind of about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
This teaching is saying that dharmata is the nature of dharmas, therefore the only gateway to dharmata is through dharmas.
Mm-hmm.
It's through phenomena. So, yeah. So actually, I see what this one of the Sharmapas, an old Tibetan teacher said, is actually not so much about the practice, it's the definition of the conventional truth. This just struck me because I've never heard it quite put this way. The simple clarity of appearances right in front of us without manipulating them is the conventional truth. In other words, things just the way that they appear before we like do anything about mm-hmm. them is the conventional truth. You could say things in front of us when we're saying like, oh, this is my bag, I'm gonna like, I use it to put things in and I'm gonna take it somewhere now. It's like, then actually we're not really engaging, as I understand this, it's not exactly the conventional truth anymore. Now it's just like pure, you know, fixated delusion that this is a bag and I use it for such and such. But just to like be with it without, I'm talking, manipulation here is like not even the manipulation of like, oh, it's so useful for what such and such. It's more or less like, wow, there's that. you know, just like being with it really directly is the, because it's just, then it's this mere appearance. It's like the conventional truth. But if I'm going to use this, take this is a bag now, I'm going to go use it for such and such. At that point, it's not really a mere appearance. Now it's a thing, an actual thing, substantially existing.
And grasped it.
I grasped it, yeah.
You might get something to push it away.
You know, if somebody steals it, I'll be upset. If it's like...
So you say, then it just becomes a thing. It's not the conventional reality of the thing, but it's also not the ultimate reality.
Yeah.
Or is it the ultimate?
Yeah, I think in this version, I'm almost hearing it like there's these three natures of things we talked about before, right? It's like the conventional truth is just dependently arisen mere appearances. Just like the clarity of the world as it's arising is a conventional truth. The ultimate truth is like the empty nature, the actual non-existence of the bag. And then this third truth, or this third non-truth, actually. Those are the two truths, the conventional and the ultimate. And then there's this third nature that we call the imputational nature, that's like where we have the name bag connected with like signs and marks, and then we really think that it's a substantially existent bag. That's like not even the conventional truth. To say like, no, this really is a bag, that's not even the conventional truth. That's just, yeah. It's not a truth. It's not a truth.
Nature.
It's a reification?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a reification. Yeah, it's a reification. Yeah.
And that's Yogacara, right?
Yeah, Yogacara has these three natures. And again, there's different people say divide those into the two truths somewhat differently. Mm-hmm. But I kind of like this model for now, mm-hmm. is that the other dependent nature is the conventional truth. And that's just, the appearance of things by conditions coming together. Like, and particularly this is in the kind of like the way the mind and the sense faculties work, you know. So like, you know, the eye faculty meets like color and touch and sound, and all these things come together, and then there's this imputation. Oh yeah, that's happened before. When those things all come together, I call it a bag. And but you could say before, if we're watching really carefully, we may be able to just, as this teacher says, the simple clarity of the appearance as it is, without the slightest manipulation of even what did you say? Reification is. Is an other dependent before the reification, because reification is the fundamental manipulation of things, actually. All other bigger manipulations come from this one of like, no, this is a bag. Mm-hmm. Then the next manipulation is like, and I'm going to use it like this.
Well, is this teaching then saying that the ultimate includes both conventional and the imputational reification?
Yeah, especially today's teaching, if we get to it, I think is Dogen is really into this thing of like not, he knows about, I think, these three natures, but like he's always emphasizing the non-duality between them, mm-hmm. and non-difference between them. But I think it's really helpful to look at how the differences can be defined before we just merge it all together. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's like, everything's just one. We're like, well, that doesn't really help much. I mean, it might sometimes. But it helps to look at the distinctions, how we say reification of things is like a really different experience than just clearly being with appearances. Mm-hmm. And that's actually a different experience than like there's really nothing there, knowing that there's really... looking for the essence behind things and not finding one. And so all three of those are slightly different, but they're like all closely related. Yeah, and Dogen's kind of saying, well, they're all just manifestation of the ultimate. Even reification, which he's going to get into here. So we're up to this point where, on page 2, where Shakyamuni Buddha said, according to this cause in Peter Levitt, aspects of thusness are no other than the nature of thusness. So this is a place where I, excuse me, Kaz and Peter, but I think they really like missed it here. Because this is a quote from the Lotus Sutra, and I think that they, if they looked at it, it's that you never translate it that way. So the Lotus Sutra in Dogen loves the Lotus Sutra, and he loves this section maybe more than any other section, this paragraph. In the chapter 2 on skillful means, the skillful means chapter, the Buddha is saying, the Dharma which the Buddha has perfected is the foremost, unprecedented Dharma, and difficult to understand. Only a Buddha, together with a Buddha, can fathom the true marks of all dharmas. So that sentence in particular, Dogen has a whole essay called Only a Buddha Together with a Buddha, and he has another fascicle on the second half of the sentence, the true marks of all phenomena. Shoho ji so and yo yui butsu yo butsu. So that sentence in particular was, I think it's not just coincidence that the Tendai school that Dogen grew up in was totally all about the Lotus Sutra and also about this section. So the Buddha's saying, this Dharma that I'm about to teach in the Lotus Sutra is just, you know, amazingly unprecedented and difficult to understand. Only a Buddha and the Buddha can fathom these true marks of all phenomena. And in parentheses, two marks of all phenomena is the dharmata of all dharmas, is be another way to say it. And you can read Dogen's whole fascicle about called the true marks of all phenomena. And then he goes on to say, only a Buddha together with a Buddha can fathom the true marks of all phenomena. That is to say, all dharmas have such a characteristic, such a nature, such an embodiment, such a potency, such a function, such a cause, such a condition, such an effect, such a recompense, and such a complete fundamental whole. So this is called the 10 suchnesses, according to the Chen Tai school. And it's an important teaching of that school, whose whole volumes have been written about. And several translations of the Lotus Sutra have a big footnote there. And the other English one has another footnote. It says almost the same thing, that says this is this Chen Tai teaching of the 10 suchnesses. And however, this Sanskrit text that we have of this doesn't actually say it that way, or it's not emphasizing suchness. The Sanskrit text doesn't say ta-ta-ta, which is how we usually would say suchness. It just says, like, the, you know, how those phenomena are, how their nature is, something like that. And so it looks like the Juri, the founder of Tian Tai School in China, he was doing this kind of like a little bit of like a word play, like Dogen likes to do. He like picked up on the Chinese translation of the Lotus Sutra that has this this term nyoze, which means such, or but also means just like this. And he picked up on the meaning that's not just using saying, well, they all have, you know, characteristics like this, and they have a nature like this. It's just kind of using this kind of colloquially. The Tian Tai founder, like, use that to mean suchness. So talking about these 10 types of suchness, the suchness of characteristics, the suchness of nature, the suchness of embodiment, and so on, and then expounded on that. So Dogen knew about this because it's important Tiantai teaching. And so that's just it. We can go on about this section of the Lotus Sutra, but Dogen's is quoting the first line of that sentence here, where you know, in the Lotus Sutra it says all dharmas, all phenomena have such characteristics, have such a nature, and those are the first two of the 10. So I think you know, if you're translating it according to the Lotus Sutra, he's just excerpting this little piece, but I think it would be you would just, if you're just pulling out that piece, it would be like Shakyamuni Buddha said, such characteristics, such nature. That would be how I would translate it. Such characteristics, comma, such nature, dot, dot, dot. Like, and there's another eight. He's kind of just excerpting. It's kind of funny. And maybe he's doing that little play here, because you could, because the way Chinese works is, you could put like an is in between there. Maybe. You wouldn't, I think you wouldn't usually, but I think you kind of could say, such characteristics is such nature. So that's what, like, Kaz really says, are no other than, he equates these two. It really doesn't say anything like, are no other than. It just says, literally, nyoze so, nyoze sho, this sentence, which means such aspects or characteristics, such nature. Literally.
And such characteristics referring to this thing that isn't talked about here, or referring to the prior?
Referring to, in the Lotus Sutra, it just says, well, it's interesting because the Lotus Sutra is, only a Buddha together with a Buddha can fathom the true characteristics, it's the same character, true characteristics of all dharmas. It's this word like lakshana in Sanskrit, which means like characteristics or marks or qualities of all phenomena. So the true qualities of all phenomena, jiso, the true quality, the true aspects, the true characteristics of all phenomena is dharmata. I mean, that's what I think is implied in the Lotus Sutra. It doesn't say that directly, but that's what Dogen writes about in his fascicle. Emptiness is the true characteristics of all phenomena. The Heart Sutra says all dharmas have this characteristic of emptiness. It's the same. It's the same Chinese character there. So all dharmas have the lakshana of emptiness. Our translation says all dharmas are marked by emptiness. Mm-hmm. It's the same word here. So that's, you could say, the true mark of all phenomena is emptiness, or dharmata, suchness. And so only a Buddha and a Buddha can fathom the true marks of all phenomena. That is to say, all phenomena have such a mark. So he uses that same word again. They have such a characteristic. They have such a mark. And they have such a nature.
And Dogen is saying, instead of saying only a Buddha and a Buddha, he simply says Shakyamuni Buddha.
Because he's not quoting the earlier part of the sentence. He's just excerpting these four words, actually, or six words. Nyoze so, nyoze sho. So Shakyamuni said, almost like dot, dot, dot. It's like the middle of a sentence, actually. Such characteristics, such nature. And other translations put it more like that. And then this thing of character marks, you know, or qualities or aspects is a little funny, but I think you could say that too. Are like the ways that we know things. They're the, usually we think of marks or characteristics as the world of dharmas. Mm-hmm. You know, world of like, you know, black and brown and cold and hot. These are all characteristics of things. That's the appearance of the conventional world of dharmas. And then nature is like the empty, you know, absence of any true essence in those marks of cold and hot and so on. So it's almost like to say, like, marks and phenomena, or, you know, characteristics and nature, I hear these as a common expression of the two truths of dharmas and dharmata. They're like synonyms in a way of dharma and dharmata, marks and nature. I think this is all woven in to this. Dogen picks up on, because he loves this section of the Lotus Sutra, and we've been talking about these two different sides of things.
Marks
and characteristics is the same. Yeah, different translations of lakshana, and then nature, or, you know, meaning the true nature, is the way things actually are, which is empty. So, and all phenomena, but all phenomena have such characteristics, and they have such a nature. So, in a way, this little section here, I hear, is like a little summary of the two truths. All phenomena have these characteristics where they appear as the conventional truth, and they have such a nature of being completely ungraspable and empty, the ultimate truth. So, you know, that's a lot going on in this little section here that's not at all clear in this translation. Although, you know, in a way, what Kaz is doing here, even though it doesn't say that in the original, it's emphasizing the unity of these two truths. Right? It's saying aspects or characteristics of thusness are no other than the nature of the true nature of thusness. And that's true. So what he said, so it's a nice statement. Yeah, form itself is emptiness. It's no other than emptiness. And Dogen's going to go on to say this. So maybe he intentionally put it there to say, like, this is where we're going with this. Sure. So Shakyamuni Buddha said, such characteristics, such nature. Then Dogen says, thus flowers blossoming and leaves falling are such nature. Or here it says, the nature of thusness. Nature of thusness is really kind of a stretch, I think. It's more like such nature. So he's just, and poetically say, flowers blossoming and leaves falling, these are the things of the world coming and going, right? Phenomena and appearances, characteristics of flowers and leaves. So, you know, traditionally, when people would make this distinction between these two truths, they'd say, well, in the ultimate truth, there are no leaves falling and blossoms blooming, right? Like the Heart Sutra says. No eyes, no ears, no flowers, no leaves. Right? So that's one way to look at things, is in the realm of dharmata, or emptiness, or suchness, nothing's happening. And now Dogen says, foolish people think that there cannot be flowers blossoming and leaves falling in the realm of dharma nature. Foolish people, maybe even the Heart Sutra is like a foolish person, because it would say that, wouldn't it? It does say that. So that's one way to look at things, is that in dharmata, there are no dharmas. Dharmata is the nature of dharmas, but it's free of all phenomena and things coming and going, like flowers blossoming and leaves falling. There's no coming and going in dharma nature, foolish people say, Dogen says. Because he's trying to unify these, right? He's saying, even though, you know, some great dharma teachers in the history of dharma teaching have said that very thing, that in dharma nature there's no blossoming and falling. But Dogen doesn't like to make that distinction. So he says, if you think in this way, don't ask others about this, but just pretend that your doubt is your expression. Well, I think this is a dynamic translation thing where, you know, I don't know enough of the language to unpack this completely, but the other translations bring it out in quite a different way. And I think that several of them, where it says pretend, it's more like, the meaning there is more like to model something, which is related to the word pretend, but to model something. So another translation is, don't ask others, but just model your doubt on an expression. So that's quite a different feeling, right? And Thomas Cleary, in his footnote on this, says, he understands this as Dogen promoting koan practice. Yeah, and meaning like, model your doubt, set up your doubt on an expression.
As a part of the Dharma expression?
I think he means actually, even like a traditional expression, like set up your doubt based on these old stories of the koans that are expressions. How does he translate it? He says, you should model your doubt on verbal expression. And then this it goes on to say, this little section here that he feels is about, like, take it up like a koan, is repeat it a few times as if quoting it from others, then you'll be able to be released from your doubt. So Cleary's translation is of that whole section is you should model your doubt on verbal expression, bringing it up as others have said it in the past. You should investigate it over and over again. Then there will be escape from your previous doubt.
Is that as if quoting from others because others have it right and you don't have it right, or quoting what you don't have right?
I don't know exactly. This is, seems like one of these really difficult points here, but I'm understanding it as
or which one are you repeating?
I think you have this doubt that that flowers fall in dharmata, right? And so like bring up some saying for others that's about this topic. That's how I'm hearing it.
Okay.
For example, like a lot of koans are about this topic, actually, are about the topic of in vast emptiness, nothing's happening. The koans are often pointing back to, no, things are happening.
Don't ignore cause and effect.
That's the one I thought of. I'm like,
don't
ignore cause and effect.
I thought of the fox koan. I thought, you know, again, I don't know if this is what's really happening here, but this is how I understood Cleary's footnote says, this passage seems to point to koan practice, specifically the use of ancient model koan, kosoku koan, Zen sayings or stories used to focus awareness in certain ways. So I almost hear it like Dogen saying, if you have doubt about this, now bring up one of these old stories, like Baijiang's fox, where does an awakened person fall into cause and effect or not? So we might retranslate that in our case to say, does a person in dharmata still relate to dharmas or not? That would be one way to, does a person who's awakened to the true nature of things, dharmata, do they still have to deal with phenomena? And then that teacher says, no, they don't. This is like Dogen's, foolish people, right? Say that, no, nothing's happening in dharmata. They don't have to deal with it.
And then they turn into a fox.
Because there's the teaching that a bodhisattva dwells in the convention.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. That too. So that's, again, why Dogen would say, these are foolish people to say, because then bodhisattvas couldn't relate to falling flowers and blossoming flowers and falling leaves. And if sentient beings are really sad because their leaf fell, the bodhisattva would be like, well, I don't care because it didn't really fall. and Dogen's saying, but then how can we help? How can the bodhisattva help?
Right.
So, no, I see. In the space of suchness, there's the appearance of flowers falling and your tears falling because that leaf fell. And let's talk about it. Or let's go walking in the autumn leaves and celebrate the leaves falling together. Mm. But it's so sad. Come, I'll take my hand. Bodhisattva might say. Whereas foolish people might say, no, it's not worth talking about because there's nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. So if we have this doubt about this, we can take up all these old stories, like I thought of that one too. Like Nettie's been talking about last week. By Dunks Fox.
Maybe ones like oak tree in the courtyard.
There's another one. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's the other one I thought of.
Expression.
Yep. Yeah. Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? Oak tree in the courtyard. Or the other one I thought of, what is Buddha? Which is also they're always asking that in these old koans. And Buddha is kind of like dharmata, right? The vast expanse of ungraspable. Usually when they mean Buddha, they mean like dharmakaya, right? The dharmakaya, the boundless, ungraspable nature of mind is Buddha, right? What is Buddha? 3 pounds of flax. These kinds of expressions are all about that dharmata is like the dharmas right in front of us in their specificity. But as this Tibetan teacher said, just like clearly just being with them without manipulating the 3 pounds of flax. Just like 3 pounds of flax. I can even count three. It's like weird. That's like getting even more detailed, right? And it's three as opposed to two, but it's more like that's all it is. Is that really? Is it substantially existent? No. Is it mine or yours? No. But yeah.
What in terms of fox?
Because in dharmata, cause and effect actually still does function. So he was reborn as a fox. There's moment to moment rebirth of a new life happening, dependent on karma. And karma of fox is kind of a symbol for maybe kind of a little bit evasive or trying to escape.
Sly,
yeah. No, he doesn't fall into anything. This is just what, I am a fox. I'm a sly, evasive kind of guy, and now for 500 lives I'm going to appear that way. So it's more like, it's a kind of, almost like folk story kind of koan, right, about cause and effect. And then, you know this story? Oh, well. the end of the story is he's 500 lifetimes as a fox, and then he goes to Baijiang and he says, the fox says, how can I be released from this? Is what happened. I gave this answer. An awakened person in Dharmata doesn't fall into cause and effect, and I fell into cause and effect by answering that. How can I be released? And Baijiang says, as a person in Dharmata, an awakened person, does not obscure, you might say, does not manipulate tonight cause and effect. They don't mess with cause and effect. They don't obscure it. They don't. They harmonize with cause and effect. They're one with cause and effect. It doesn't. It's not the cause and effect disappears. And then he was released from the fox body. So that story is really about the relationship of these two truths in one sense. And to think that the ultimate doesn't include the conventional is basically wrong. and the conventional will keep playing out in a painful way if we deny it. So that koan kind of goes very nicely with this essay. And it's a middle way koan. So whatever is going on here, you can model your doubt about this on an ancient expression and repeat it a few times, which is the practice in koan practice. Does an enlightened person fall into cause and effect? Or, you know, Buddha is 3 pounds of flax. Buddha is 3 pounds of flax. Or whatever. Then you will be able to be released from your doubt. This is one way to hear this anyway. It's a strange little section, I think. It goes on. Such a doubt is not wrong, however. It merely lacks clarity. Or another translation is, such a doubt is not wrong, it's just thought without understanding. So this is kind of, well, we're again unifying these different sides. You say doubt is what obscures suchness, right? But then saying doubt is actually part of suchness too. It's the thought that doesn't understand right. Even after you have clarity, do not let your earlier thinking disappear. Or even if you have, after you understand, your earlier thinking does not disappear.
Thought without. What?
What would you say?
It's just thought without understanding.
Understanding. What does it say? Thought without understanding.
That's what you said.
Yeah.
That's another
thing. Another translation. Thought without understanding. Yeah. So in other words, now we're bringing up this topic of thought, shirio, which is the same, there's different ways of talking about thinking, but this term is what is used in Dogen's classic point of think of what doesn't think, how do you think what doesn't think, non-thinking, that's this term shirio. So it's like we're investigating what is thought in the realm of Dharmata. It doesn't disappear. It's just thought without grasping it, we might say. Buddhas can think.
Right.
But it's not that thinking binds us, but grasping is what binds us, which is, as you said, reification of thought, which is very hard not to do when we're thinking about something, especially if we're thinking about something important. Like Kathy said, we can just say, like, you know, oh, it doesn't really matter ultimately, but sometimes it's pretty hard to say, this doesn't matter. I mean, this really matters. Right? And, but this thought is actually just a manifestation, we might say, of Dharma nature. Yes?
So is it that that what he's saying is, this is it? Dharmatai isn't elsewhere. I mean, it's
Right here. It's right here. But but when you say, I mean, it's interesting because that phrase is going to show up right at the end of the essay. This is it, mm-hmm. And it's kind of like to say this is it is like misses it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you could say, you know, in the realm of speaking about it, which we're in a class, that's what we're doing. So in that case, it's like, it's right here. Dharmata is not, or maybe if we want to be more careful, we might say, it's not somewhere else. Mm-hmm. It's safer to talk in negatives in this realm. It's not somewhere else. And yet, if we say, this is it. I mean, it's tricky because from a certain perspective, we could say, yeah, this is Dharmata. What is Buddha? 3 pounds of flax. And then, but if we think that like this, you know, piece of paper, the way I think of it as a piece of paper, which is like, has, when I look at it, it seems to have like paperness, which is like its kind of essential quality of paper. Before I analyze it or anything, it seems to be that way. You say, that's not actually the Dharmata. The Dharmata is right there. It's almost like hidden in the form, which is just reminds me of, we'll continue to talk about these two truths, but in Sanskrit, the conventional truth is called Samvritti Satya, and Samvritti means to obscure something, and also to hide something, and also to reveal something, which kind of all goes together, right? It's like a cover over something. It hides it and obscures it, but when you lift the cover, that's the place that it's revealed, right?
That's the two aspects of it. I mean, that's the So you have ultimate truth. Mm. And then the conventional truth are these other two parts to make it three.
Well, I would almost say without even saying the three, you could say conventional truth serves the function to hide the ultimate truth, but it also serves the function to reveal it because, as Helen said, it's right there. It almost holds. The ultimate truth. The Dharma is what holds the Dharmata in a way. But it also, the Dharma is what hides the Dharmata at the same time. And both of those meanings are in this word Samvritti, before we even get into three natures.
Well, but it's that's actually what this is saying. It's not three parts.
It's two aspects
of
the conventional truth.
Right.
Yeah. Two aspects of the conventional truth.
Hiding and revealing.
Amazing. And I think it's very cool to kind of contemplate these things. It's all like this is all like a conceptual model of how things are, but it's like people spend some time working at these models. Right? I think that they point to how our experience is.
Sentence of that paragraph, even after you have clarity, do not let your earlier thinking disappear. Don't grab on to that and try to hold it.
And also, it's kind of honoring our earlier thinking.
Because it's what brought us here.
And it's also implying, I think also, it's just thinking in general doesn't disappear. I think it's also part of the implication when understanding arises. The flowers blossoming and leaves falling are no other than flowers blossoming and leaves falling. So, yes. That's kind of a little bit like, I think, where Helen was going with, this is it, you know. Flowers falling are just flowers falling. You know, it's so simple, right? It's so simple. The thought that there cannot be flowers blossoming and leaves falling in Dharma nature is itself Dharma nature. That's like classic Dogen. I love it when he does this stuff, right? In other words, he did this before, we talked about, I think, somewhere in the essay, where it's like, thought like, this cannot be it. You know, that very, the thought that this cannot be it is it, right? So great. I mean, and this is, I mean, it's true, and it's like a great, I think, instruction for our life. And Zazen, even, you could say, in Zazen, I'd be like, my Zazen is just like so blurry today. I'm so not clear. I feel half asleep, and I'm just like all these storylines going, and like, you know, this is really not Dogen Zazen. You could say that thought is like a pure, perfect expression of like Dogen Zazen. And likewise, you know, it obscures, that thought obscures to Zazen, and it reveals to Zazen. That's because the thought is a conventional truth. So that thought is itself Dharma nature. It is thought that doubts and is released from doubt. So that's the two sides. Yeah.
Doubts and thought is released from doubt.
Mm-hmm. You know, thought, the obscuring quality of thought is like the doubt. Doubt is like kind of trapping us in this uncomfortable, like dissatisfied place. And also, it's thought that's released from doubt. Mm-hmm. We might even say at the same time, mm-hmm. I think it's in the unity of the two truths, thought is doubting here, this can't be it, this can't be it. And at the same time, that thought is being released from doubt. And at any moment, we can just shift the perspective a hair's breadth, right? Mm-hmm. And
that's a good description of what happens with koan study.
Mm-hmm.
You're applying thought very actively and intentionally, but in a way you're doing that to be released from all of that doubt and all of that analytical thinking.
Yeah. And particularly doubt, right, in koan practice. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very doubt generated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like Hakuin is, you know, these foundations of great faith in your Buddha nature, great doubt, generating this great doubt through koans. I think partly it's the doubt of like, how could this be it, even though I have great faith that this is it, but also the doubt through like, wow, what? How could Buddha be 3 pounds of flax? And then great determination to like, not, you know, to hold the tension of the great faith and the great doubt with determination. Thus it is thought that as it is Dharma nature. It's that word again, nyo, which means such or as it is. Thus thought such as it is Dharma nature. The entire thought of Dharma nature has such a face or characteristic. Yeah, so that's going back to this whole point about characteristics and marks and their suchness. So the entire thought of the thought of Dharma nature has such a face, or such an appearance, we might say. And it's, again, playing with such, it has such an appearance. We talk about appearances and suchness. This is such an appearance. All are no other than Dharma nature, mentioned by Matsu, this, you know, in the original story, expresses 8 or 9 out of 10. The original story is just, you know, basically all sentient beings have never left Dharma nature. Everything is no other than Dharma nature. That statement from the story that Dogen's been commenting on expresses 8 or 9 out of 10, but there's much he did not express. So this is another kind of classic thing that Dogen likes to do, is praise a great story and say, but, you know, we could say a lot more. For example, he did not say, all Dharma nature are without the need to leave Dharma nature. So the original sentence is, all sentient beings never leave Dharma nature. So this is like, all Dharma nature never leaves Dharma nature. He could have said, all Dharma nature is entirely Dharma nature. you know, I think he's just bringing out all these different aspects. But again, Cleary has these footnotes on like almost like each one of these sentences where he kind of, you know, in this section especially, and where he's, it's maybe his own just thoughts about this. And his take here was like talking about an individual Dharma nature versus like a universal Dharma nature. So like we could say the falling leaf has the Dharma nature of emptiness, and then there's like the Dharma nature of the entire universe. And you could say those, the little Dharma nature of the leaf and then the universal Dharma nature are the same Dharma nature, right? But we could almost talk about these two types, two different Dharma natures. They're not really different, but we could, we might, it's maybe because we might get into like the emptiness of this book, you know, is like, depends on the book, right? We're talking, it's a particular emptiness. It's not the emptiness of the bag, right? It's the emptiness of the book. But that emptiness of the book compared to like vast emptiness in the 10 directions, what's going on there? It's like a little bit of space in big space. And it just, by reflecting on this, it just helps break down all our ideas about differences and sameness. Yeah.
I've just never thought of putting those two words together, and it kind of makes me laugh. Like particular emptiness.
Yeah, particular emptiness. Yeah, particular emptiness. But in a way, it's nice to look at particular emptiness because we don't want to make it into some vague, blurry idea of like, yeah, this emptiness. It's more like, you know, and then it's again the relationship of the two truths. Does the emptiness of the book depend on the form of the book?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, actually, it's not some like emptiness. There's not some emptiness like floating around without phenomena. There's like a particular emptiness. So we could say, and this is what Cleary, I think, is saying, is that Dharma nature is entirely Dharma nature. It's kind of like, you know, the Dharma nature of something is the entirety of Dharma nature. Something like this.
Well, and Dogen says, he says that Matsu expresses 8 or 9 out of 10, but there's much he did not express. So, but he, this does not add up to 10. This adds up to like 16.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it's kind of just like one of those Zen expressions that you only got 80%.
Yeah.
But it's saying what, that's what Cleary is saying there, isn't it? Yeah, it's the same thing? That,
what
you just quoted from
Cleary. Uh-huh. Yeah. Is saying that it has to add up to
I'm sorry.
That there's these 10 or 16 things are all one thing?
What are their particular pieces?
Yeah.
Numberless.
Yeah.
Particulars of it.
And there's 16, did you say?
No, I just was guessing. I mean, because, more than 10. No,
because in Chandrakirti, this Indian commentary on Nagarjuna that I was studying in Nepal, it's got this classic thing of the 16 kinds of emptiness, which is, you know, it's kind of like what we're talking about. And of course they're all the same. How can you make distinctions in emptiness? But he's making this point of like, I can't remember what they all are, you know, but they're like, you know, the emptiness of forms, the emptiness of mind, you could say. There's, you know, they're like different ways of looking at emptiness. The emptiness of emptiness is one of them. Like, you know, that's a little different to start really investigating what does that mean compared to the emptiness of the book, right? But, of course, emptiness is emptiness. And flowers falling is flowers falling. So all sentient beings are without the need to leave sentient beings. Yeah. Again, the original sentence is all sentient beings have never left Dharma nature. So now Dogen's saying he didn't talk about Dharma nature's never left Dharma nature. He didn't talk about sentient beings never leave sentient beings. He just, you know, going through every permutation of these sentences. All sentient beings are a small part of Dharma nature. All sentient beings are a small part of sentient beings. All Dharma nature is half of sentient beings. And there clearly gets into this point again of like sentient beings from a human viewpoint is just one aspect of sentient beings from all points of view, like we might say, from a snail's point of view or something. I don't know, I think he's just playing with these, trying to really actually, instead of just reading just one of these crazy Dogen paragraphs, he's like, actually take each sentence and kind of reflect on it. Like maybe there's actually something to, a point that can turn us a little bit even. All Dharma nature is half of sentient beings. Half of sentient beings are half of Dharma nature. There, he has this footnote of like dharmas and Dharma nature are like two halves of like a sphere or something. They go together, which kind of makes sense that they always go together, right? So half of Dharma nature, half of sentient beings is half of Dharma nature, which is a little bit like the particularity piece again, like, you know, saying this particular number of sentient beings is this particular number of Dharma nature. Half and half. Beyond sentient beings, or literally it says mu, or no sentient beings, is Dharma nature. Dharma nature is not sentient beings, or beyond sentient beings. Dharma nature is released from Dharma nature. Sentient beings are released from sentient beings. That released their sentient beings is Datsu Raku, which is Dogen's classic. Shinjin Datsu Raku is body and mind drop off. So it's a phrase, when he combines it, I think he's using one of his favorite things, sloughing off or dropping off. Sentient beings drop off sentient beings. Dharma nature drops off Dharma nature. When we hear, what we hear from Matsu is merely no sentient beings have the need to come out of Dharma nature samadhi. But he did not say Dharma nature has no need to come out of sentient being samadhi. That's a great one. He just reverses the sentence. Dharma nature samadhi, which I think is Matsu maybe even coined this term. Dharmata samadhi is this way all sentient beings are in Dharma nature samadhi all the time. That's what he's saying, but he doesn't say, according to Dogen, that Dharma nature never comes out of sentient being samadhi, or Dharma nature samadhi goes in and out of sentient being samadhi.
So that's the 8 or 10, 8 or 9.
Yeah, 8 or 9. Or,
it's like that's a summary paragraph of the.
It's all the things that Matsu could have said but didn't, right?
And it kind of explains why Dogen uses the two interchangeably.
Sentient beings?
No, Dharma. When he says Dharma nature samadhi and Dharma nature, he uses both.
Oh, yeah. They're pretty interchangeable, I think.
Yeah.
As we talked about maybe in a previous class,
right.
It seemed like samadhi adds a kind of experiential quality, whereas Dharma nature is more like a philosophical, an ontological statement about the nature of things. Mm-hmm. Samadhi is like the experience of being absorbed in the nature of things, mm-hmm. But maybe no difference really.
Or this brings them together.
Yeah. And sentient being samadhi is what we're, of course, all in all the time. And I think the Matsu didn't, that last sentence, Dharma nature samadhi goes in and out of sentient being samadhi, that's a nice one to look at. Like, I think of Lin Ji's saying, there's a true person of no rank, no characteristics, that's moving in and out of the portals of our face. So you could say that true person of no rank is like dharmata, samadhi, and it's moving in and out of sentient beings, like which sentient beings are sentient, right? Where these faculties of eyes and ears, you know, dharma nature moves in and out through. It's like, it's a cool idea. Usually the sutras don't talk that way, right? But the Zen ancestors could talk that way.
I'm just wondering about kind of the didactic technique here. I mean, he could have told us all of this without even bringing Matsu in at all.
Yeah. I mean, being kind of critical of Matsu?
Well, just, he could have, you know, Dobie could have just told us all of these paragraphs and saying Matsu didn't say
yeah, 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 yeah.
It's some technique here.
It is. It's a Dogen thing. It's a Zen sparring kind of thing. I think, you know, the Dogen likes to get kind of like critique, even though he loves Matsu. Right? So sometimes some ancestors he really like doesn't love. He really gets kind of like really critical. But he often does this kind of technique of like almost it's like playing with a story. So Matsu said this great story, and we just praised it, and we kind of unpacked his story for many paragraphs. And now there's all these things that he could have said that, but didn't. But now I'm gonna say, you know. So it's kind of this, yeah, it's a Zen style thing.
Is it like
Dharma
combat?
Yeah, it has that flavor, like, yeah, and kind of like this sort of one upsmanship kind of thing is. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit obnoxious, but it's part of the tradition sometimes.
Yeah. There's a phrase for it, but I wasn't sure what it was.
Yeah, maybe like Dharma combat. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, and I think it's in a very playful, lighthearted way in this case.
Yeah, especially when you get to the end.
So.
It feels like it can be instructional too, like, you might think that you think this thing, there. You might forget that you're not thinking this thing.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's and Dogen, yeah, it is. And actually, what Dogen often does is Dogen's always bringing up these old koans and praising them, and then kind of reversing them and kind of saying, but it's not limited to this way that we usually think of it, and like, here's all the other ways that we could think. This is part of Dogen's style, too, is just expanding our, you know, contemplation and openness of mind, like as far as it can go, mm-hmm. in a kind of playful and poetic and sometimes absurd way. But yeah, I think that is the point, actually, is let's keep seeing endlessly how many ways we can see everything. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, what's not heard from Matsu are Dharma nature becomes Buddha. Sentient beings realize Dharma nature, and there's another sentence that got left out of this translation. Dharma nature realizes sentient beings, or insentient beings do not have the need to come out of Dharma nature.
What is that?
So I think Dharma nature becomes Buddha maybe nothing needs to be said about that. Mm-hmm. Sentient beings realize or verify, this is an important term for Dogen, this show. Sentient beings verify or confirm or realize Dharma nature. That's what they do. That's practice and verification are not two. And Dharma nature verifies sentient beings. That has a little bit of that flavor of the Genjo Koan, these two sides. The myriad things coming forth and, you know, confirming ourself is a little bit like Dharma nature comes forward and verifies sentient beings. Mm-hmm. And insentient beings do not have a need. So it's all, we've been talking about sentient beings, mm-hmm. so now he just brings up this other term that the Zen people talk about, you know, insentient beings speaking the Dharma. So he's just like, let's just, for the full roundedness, now let's not forget that insentient beings also never come out of Dharma nature. It's just the full range. Now, ask Matsu. You know, or we should now ask Matsu, what do you call sentient beings? So, before we do this, and we don't have much time, but this is again a place where the translation misses this, I think. It's a story that you may have heard because it's a classic Zen story that is being referred to, where Nanyue goes to visit the sixth ancestor. and Nanyue shows up, and Huineng, his ancestor, says, where are you coming from? And he says, from Mount Sung. And Six Answers says, what is it that thus comes? Mm-hmm. Have you heard that one? What is it that thus comes? Dogen likes the story because he quotes it. Here it's in Shobo Genzo Henzan, All-Inclusive Study. And so here it says, the old Buddha, the Six Ancestors, said, what is it that thus comes? And Nanyue all-inclusively studied that lump of mud for 8 years and then presented this move to the ancient Buddha. He's saying, I understand now. When I first came here, you instructed me, what is it that thus comes? And Six Ancestors said, well, what do you understand now? And Nanyue said, speaking about it won't hit the mark. Mm-hmm. Or another translation is, to say it's this misses the mark. And then the story goes on that Six Ancestors says, well then, does it not depend on practice and realization? And Nanyue says, it's not that there's no practice and realization, it's just that they can't be defiled. And then Six Ancestors says, this non-defilement is what all the Buddhas and ancestors have realized through India and China. I am like this and you are like this too. So, what is it that thus comes? What is it that comes thus? I mean, the Tathagata is a translation of the thus come one. And it doesn't exactly say what's the Tathagata, but maybe that's played with in there too. What is it that thus comes? You have just come. What is it that thus comes? And it's playing with thusness. What is this, you, coming, you know, thus? He couldn't say anything for 8 years. He was working on this with great doubt for 8 years. And it was such a great story because, like, I finally come to the answer after 8 years. Well, what's the answer? To say it's this misses the mark. It's going to be a big dramatic answer, right? To say anything misses it. So that's the story that Dogen is saying. Now ask Matsu, what do you call sentient beings? If you call Dharma nature sentient beings, it's no other than what is it that thus comes? It's the quote right out of that koan story. If you call sentient beings, it's no other than to say it's this misses the mark. Mm-hmm. Or to speak about it misses the mark. So he's weaving in that other story, and I think it's making a point that if you call Dharma nature sentient beings, you know, if you limit Dharma nature to sentient beings, it's both sides again. Is Dharma nature being limited to sentient beings, or is Dharma nature no other than sentient beings? That is, what is it that thus comes? You know, this sentient being that showed up at the Six Ancestors' door. It's a sentient being, a particular person that came from Mount Sung. What is it that thus comes? It's a sentient being and thusness. What is that? And then if you call sentient beings, it's no other than to say it's this, this is the mark. To say sentient beings are just sentient beings. To say it's this, this is the mark. Now, tell me what it is. or another translation, speak quickly. So, or to speak about it, maybe so we could also translate it, to speak about it misses the mark. Now speak quickly. The end.
Mm-hmm. That's almost like you have to speak before you think it.
Yeah. You have to speak before you think it.
Because if it comes from a thought, that's not it.
But I just got this. I haven't read it. But, and this is Dongshan.
Dongshan, just this is it.
Yeah. And I've been looking for hot and cold here, and I mean it's here. I just haven't really studied it, but because that's mentioned earlier. So I'm trying to see if there's connection, or if this mm-hmm. is something other.
Well,
than this.
Of course it's all connected. And Dongshan was the one who started his great poem, "The Teaching of Thusness." Has been mm-hmm. intimately communicated mm-hmm. by Buddhas and ancestors. Mm-hmm. And now you have it.
Mm-hmm. But that's all before Dogen, too.
Yeah, yeah. And that's Dogen's direct ancestor. Mm-hmm. And the Nyoze no Ho, the Dharma of thusness, has been intimately mm-hmm. transmitted. Mm-hmm. So this is the Dharma of Dharmata.
Yeah.
The Dharmata of Dharma. This union of the two truths has been intimately communicated. The middle way has been intimately communicated, and now you have it, so keep it well. So it's a lot of fun, as always, for me to study Dogen and unpack it a little bit, and to look into Dharma nature. Anything to say? Speak quickly. What could we say? That's perfect conclusion to our class series. May all sentient beings never leave Dharma nature, wearing clothes, eating food, celebrate this ancient and present way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. And Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.